Welcome everyone, I'm your host, Emerson Green, and today we'll be continuing our series about epistemology. So here's one of the first questions everyone asks in epistemology. What is knowledge? What does it mean to know something? What philosophers typically engage in here is something called analysis. To correctly analyze a word, you have to give a set of conditions that correctly classifies things in all possible circumstances. That's why it's considered legitimate to raise all kinds of wild scenarios to challenge whether someone would know or fail to know something. You need to give conditions that preclude all counterexamples in order to successfully analyze the term. According to one famous definition, knowledge is justified true belief. As long as you have a belief that is justified and true, then you have knowledge, supposedly. Those are the three proposed conditions for knowledge. So take the proposition, my cats are siblings. In order to know that my cats are siblings, I have to first, at least, believe the proposition is true. I have to think that it really is the case that my cats are siblings. And I should probably mention that belief is used fairly casually in epistemology. Outside philosophy, that term is often layered with all kinds of connotations that are absent in epistemology. For philosophers, to believe a proposition is usually just to affirm or accept it, regardless of anything else. If you think humans evolved by natural selection, then you believe that humans evolved by natural selection. If, on the basis of scientific evidence, you conclude that smoking causes cancer, then you believe that smoking causes cancer. It's not a big deal to say that you believe something in epistemology. There are no implications about faith or feelings, how you came to hold that belief, whether you strongly hold the belief or merely lean in favor of it, whether that belief is reasonable, or what evidence or lack thereof supports the belief. So if we take the proposition, my cats are siblings, we have to at least believe it's true. If you think it's false that my cats are siblings, or you have no opinion on the matter, then you could never know that my cats are siblings. Second, it has to actually be true. If you think it's true that my cats are siblings, but they're in fact unrelated, then you don't know my cats are siblings. I think in order to have knowledge, you have to actually be right about the proposition in question. And you might feel that you're right, but that's a different issue entirely. The correct analysis of knowledge is not a feeling of subjective certainty. Further, it might be reasonable, given the information you have, to think that you're right, but again, that's a different issue. So it has to actually be the case that my cats are siblings, and you have to believe it is the case that my cats are siblings. For knowledge, it's necessary to at least have a true belief. So two conditions down, one to go. On to the J in JTB. To quote Michael Humer, a justified belief is one that is reasonable, one that it makes sense to hold, one that is likely to be true given the believer's evidence. So what if you have a true belief, but you came to hold this true belief on the basis of completely bizarre evidence and bad reasoning? In that case, you'd just be lucky to hold a true belief, since your belief is completely unjustified. I believe that smoking causes cancer. I affirm the proposition, smoking causes cancer, and it happens to be true. But if you ask why I believe it, say I go on an unintelligible rant about numerology and H.P. Lovecraft. My belief might be true, but it's not justified. It definitely seems wrong to claim that I know smoking causes cancer, when my belief is based entirely on a numerological reading of The Call of Cthulhu. I basically just got lucky. But if I form my belief on careful study of the relevant scientific research, then it would seem like I have a justified true belief. According to the JTB analysis, I know smoking causes cancer.
Just one small problem!
Say I want to know what time it is. So I turn to my old, big, analog clock hanging on the wall. I say, how long has that been there? Why do I even have that? The clock on the wall says it's 3, so I form the belief that it's 3 o'clock. Seems pretty reasonable to form beliefs about what time it is by looking at clocks, so I have a justified belief. Lo and behold, 3 o'clock is the correct time. However, unknown to me, the clock is broken. A broken analog clock is right twice a day, and it happens to be one of those times right now. So here I have a justified, true belief. And yet, since I formed my belief by looking at a broken clock, it still seems as though I just got lucky. I have a true belief that it's three, and I have a good justification for believing that it's three. Looking at clocks is generally how we form our beliefs about what time it is, and that's a pretty good method. And yet, I haven't escaped luck. I still just got lucky, even though I am right, and I have good reason to think I'm right. These are called Gettier cases, after the philosopher Edmund Gettier. Gettier cases show that the three conditions we've focused on are insufficient for knowledge. Gettier doesn't dispute that they're necessary for knowledge, they're just not sufficient. You can probably think of your own Gettier cases, and now that you know what they are, you'll actually stumble on them from time to time without looking for them. Since we haven't identified necessary and sufficient conditions free from counterexamples, we still don't have a complete analysis of knowledge. Remember, to analyze a word, we have to give a set of conditions that correctly classifies things in all possible circumstances. In response to Gettier cases, epistemologists have tried to improve the traditional definition by adding a fourth condition, modifying our notion of justification, or replacing justification with something else entirely. In response, philosophers have come up with other counterexamples. Then the definition is amended further, which then leads to more counterexamples, and so on and so forth. I'm not going to run through every analysis of knowledge that philosophers have ever offered, but there are dozens and dozens of them. Reliabilism, proper function, no false lemmas, relevant alternatives, sensitivity and tracking, defeasibility, and so on. To quote Humer, "To this day, there is no consensus on the proper analysis of knowledge. Indeed, for every analysis, there are counterexamples that most epistemologists would agree refute the analysis." So let's pause for a moment. Why can't epistemologists figure this out? For literally thousands of years, intelligent human beings all over the world have been trying and failing to define a word that we use all the time. We use the words know and knowledge like every day. Everyone knows how to use the terms. So why is it so hard to analyze them? By the way, there is an answer to this, which we'll come to in the next section. I think there are deep lessons to be drawn from the failure of analysis. But even if there is no totally successful analysis of knowledge that everyone can agree on, that doesn't mean they're all equally bad. True belief is not as good of an analysis as justified true belief, even though there are counterexamples to both. If you were to christen true belief as the right analysis of knowledge, there would be a ton of edge cases and seeming counterexamples, whereas if we decided justified true belief was the right analysis, there would be comparatively fewer edge cases. If you've got a definition of a term, you don't want there to be, like, mostly edge cases and counterexamples. So, what's the least bad analysis of knowledge? According to Humer, that would be the defeasibility theory. And this is one of those analyses that adds a fourth condition to JTB. Quote, S knows that P if and only if, 1, S believes that P, 2, P is true, 3, S is justified in believing that P, and 4, there are no genuine defeaters for S's justification for P. In this context, a defeater for S's justification for P is defined to be a true proposition that, when added to S's beliefs, would make S no longer justified in believing P. End quote. So that's just the JTB analysis plus the condition that there are no genuine defeaters for the justification. We should note that defeater could mean something subtly different in other contexts within epistemology. For the defeasibility analysis, what matters is that the defeater is a proposition that is true and that would make the subject no longer justified in believing the proposition if added to their beliefs. It doesn't matter if they're actually aware of the proposition or not. It also doesn't matter if there's a false proposition that we would have good reason to accept that would undermine the justification. For the defeasibility analysis, the defeater has to be a true proposition that, if added to your beliefs, would make you no longer justified in believing the proposition. So how would this avoid Gettier cases? Well, the clock is broken is a true proposition that, when added to your beliefs, would make you no longer justified in believing that it's three. The counterexamples to the defeasibility analysis are incredibly complicated and absurd. And that's all fair game in conceptual analysis. But still, not all analyses fail to an equal degree. The defeasibility theory isn't perfect, but it seems to accurately capture the meaning of the term while minimizing counterintuitive implications. Humer calls this, quote, the most nearly adequate analysis of knowledge. You might have thought up a couple objections to the defeasibility theory, like, how could you tell whether there were any genuine defeaters for a proposition? How could I really know that there aren't any defeaters for my justification? There may be a misconception about the purpose of analysis working in the background here. The point is not to help you decide in life whether you have knowledge. The point is to define knowledge, to provide a set of conditions that correctly classifies things in all possible circumstances. What does it mean to know something? That's what we're trying to figure out. I can't be absolutely certain that there are no defeaters, just like I can't be absolutely certain that my belief is true. I don't have an infallible truthometer in my possession, and yet I still think the T in JTB is a condition that needs to be there for the best analysis of knowledge. But maybe you're still bothered by something here. How could we ever know whether there are genuine defeaters? Even if we know something, can we know that we know it? First, arguing for a requirement of this kind of meta-knowledge leads to an infinite regress. It's enough to know. You don't need to know that you know. If it's the case that in order to have knowledge, you needed to know that you know, then you'd also need to know that you know that you know. But in order to know that you know that you know, you'd need to know that you know that you know that you know. And so on ad infinitum. The moral of the story is that it's enough just to know. So meta-knowledge can't be a requirement, knowing that one knows it, since that would lead to an infinite regress. But, you might wonder, doesn't it bother you at all that you can seemingly never know whether there are genuine defeaters, and hence, whether you have knowledge? Well, once again, according to the defeasibility theory, you know a proposition if you satisfy the JTB conditions plus the fourth condition on genuine defeaters. So you can know that there are no defeaters. You can know that the fourth condition is satisfied. You just need a justified, true belief, and additionally, there can't be a true proposition that, if added to your beliefs, would defeat the justification for the proposition. In this case, the proposition that there are no genuine defeaters. You can know something, and you can even know that you know it, even though it's not necessary for knowledge. If the objector still isn't happy, I would assume at this point that they're looking for something that no one can give them. They don't just want knowledge, they want certainty. But in almost all cases, you will never have absolute certainty. To quote J.L. Mackey, the demand for certainty will inevitably be disappointed, leaving skepticism in command of almost every issue. The point of analyzing knowledge is not to help me feel the warm glow of certainty, and it's also not to give me direct, practical advice like a guidance counselor. It's about understanding. Actually, as a side note, that's what most of modern analytic philosophy is about. It's not about the love of wisdom, like the ancient Greek definition. It's about understanding. Earlier, I mentioned that the defeasibility theory is considered by Humer to be the most nearly adequate analysis of knowledge. But why not entirely adequate? Why not just amend the theory so it doesn't fall prey to the admittedly convoluted counterexamples put against it? That's what leads us to the failure of analysis and a Wittgensteinian view of concepts. This next section is honestly the most exciting part to me. I don't know what that says about me, but it was something that was genuinely groundbreaking and exciting when I first learned about it, so I'm really excited to share it with you. And I should also mention that I've got another epistemology series over on counter-apologetics. That one's more focused on atheism and religion. So, this has been Walden Pod. Thank you for listening. I've been Emerson Green, and I'll talk to you next time.